What Goes On Media, this is Coming Out Stories. It's a podcast and it's about one of the most important conversations of your life. I'm your host, Emma Goswell. In this episode, we're back stateside with an actual rock and roll star. Oh yes, Melissa Ferrick is a singer-songwriter who rose to fame in the early 90s when they toured with Morrissey. They still write music, but also teach at Northeastern University in Massachusetts. I started asking them about how they identify, and it turns out that wasn't an easy question to answer.
I'm going through a period in my life where I think this idea of being gender nonconforming or non-binary definitely applies to me. I never had language like that when I was a kid, nor did I have it when I was a teenager in my 20s. I mean, I just turned 50, so I like being able to use they. I mean, I always use they and she in my signatures, but it's new for me. And so it's uncomfortable. At my age, it feels embarrassing.
Why?
It just does. That's how I feel. I feel embarrassed that I might not be non-binary enough, you know, that I'll be judged. All the same feelings that I felt when I came out, when I realized that I was queer. There's a level of embarrassment and shame and confusion and fear and longing. Well, there's a lot of things that are emotional about coming into one's queerness or whatever you want to call it, when you're coming into one's identity and the words you want to use around it as they shift throughout your life. It's just interesting that you asked me that first, just because I'm definitely in another phase.
But it's interesting because you and I are actually almost exactly the same age. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, when we were teenagers, you know, generally speaking, people were lesbian or gay. You know, I joined the Lesbian and Gay Society. We didn't even really talk about bisexuals, let alone trans people. And certainly non-binary was never mentioned, was it? So, you know, we've come a long way since we were teenagers, haven't we, as a community, I think.
Yeah. And I remember when those were the two options we had, lesbian or gay, I always wanted to just be gay. I always wanted people to use that word. I hated the word lesbian. I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it felt when I said it. It didn't feel like it fit me. Obviously, I love lesbians, but I'm just saying I didn't feel attached to it. I wished that I could use the word gay, and I just felt like I couldn't. So that's why I landed on queer when I went into my 20s, and the word queer kind of came back.
See, a lot of people find that problematic as well from our generation as well, don't they? Because you know, I've spoken to gay men that were bashed over the head and called it, so they hate the word, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the word. So I love the way that word feels. And I also like, definitely relate to gender nonconforming, for sure, 100%.
So gender nonconforming, non-binary, queer.
Yeah, there you go.
In a nutshell.
A GNCNBQ.
Brilliant. Well, we got that sorted then. So when did you first start thinking that you weren't, but let's go back to childhood, actually, that you definitely weren't maybe cisgendered or straight?
Yeah. I mean, ever since my mother actually recently told me that she found books of her journaling when I was very young. And she had written down, Melissa keeps telling me she wishes she was a boy. And that doesn't surprise me because I remember that. I remember wishing I was a boy all the time. Wanting to be a boy, wishing I was a boy, feeling sad that I wasn't a boy, but mad when people would call me a boy and I wasn't, like that I couldn't be who I was and be a boy at the same time because I was a tomboy. That was the words that we used for it then. I mean, I can remember one of my favorite gifts as a young child, like I want to say like 5 or 6, was one of my dad's bow ties. It was a clip-on black bow tie. And nice. I just freaking loved it so much. I wore it all the time. I would clip it onto my shirt or a t-shirt. I just loved it. And definitely felt like I wasn't mad about my parts. My vagina or my body. I wasn't mad about my body, but I wanted to be a boy. So I felt very much like both. And I still do. I remember also, I've been thinking about this lately. It's kind of right on point that we're having this conversation that I had forgotten that I used to practice shaving my face with the backside of my toothbrush. And longing for the opportunity to have had my father teach me how to shave. Like I've always loved the smell of shaving cream, of men's deodorant, of men's hair products. those, I shouldn't even say the word, I don't even want to use the word men's, that those are the things I've been drawn to.
And it's mad that they're genderized, isn't it, really? People laugh at me because I use Lynx shower gel. Well, I'm like, I just like the smell of it. Doesn't have to be for men, does it? It's bonkers.
That makes me crazy. And it's like having, you know, buying the men's shaving cream. It's like, it's shaving cream, or the difference between women's razors and men's razors. It's like,
but they're always more expensive, aren't they? Because they're pink and all like fancy.
Yeah, they don't work as well as the men. They're not as sharp. So it's annoying. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Why women's jeans pockets are so small. It's like, yeah, because we don't carry anything.
I've never thought about that.
Ridiculous. You could basically fit like a lipstick in there.
Yeah.
Of course, we all carry lipstick.
So, I mean, but when you were growing up, you wouldn't have had the language or the knowledge. Like, I think kids now, they know about other trans kids or other non-binary kids, don't they? And there is the support out there now if people know where to find it. But, I mean, when you were growing up, when I was growing up, there was nothing. We didn't know about trans people, did we?
No, not at all. And if there was one, they were crazy, you know, like the town cross-dresser. No, didn't have any of that language at all. So now we have so much language. I mean, I think it's awesome, but personally trying to find the words that help me express who I am and how I identify to another person, there's a lot of choices. And really, outside of helping young people feel like they're not alone, right? Is there really any point why I would express all of the, you know, who I am and who I like, you know, who I sleep with and how I identify my gender to random people walking? I just want to be in the world, in the body that I'm in the way I think and feel and relate to people without having to narrow it down to a particular set of words so that other people feel comfortable. Mm. So I'm not interested in finding words to make other people feel comfortable with who I am and how I identify and how I present. But I think it is important for me to know the words I want to use, especially with students. You know, if someone asks me, do you identify as, or are you trans, you know, and using they and she pronouns, because those feel good to me.
Well, exactly. And pronouns are important, aren't they? So, you know, people choose the wrong ones for you, you're not going to be happy. So I guess you kind of have to have those conversations, don't you, occasionally?
Yeah, but in the classroom, I mean, in academia anyway, the best practices now, from what I've been taught anyway, are that I do express mine when I introduce myself to a class. I'm like, hi, I'm Professor Farrick. I use they and she pronouns. This is where I'm from. This is what I teach. These are my research interests on day one. And then we go around the room and I say, you know, you're welcome. You know, please share your pronouns if you're comfortable doing that. Even that, even saying share your pronouns if you're comfortable, already sets up an uncomfortability for a student who hasn't landed on what pronouns they want to use. So I've actually just been saying mine, which sets a precedent, but it doesn't put a student in an uncomfortable position. I mean, this generation of college students anyway, it's habit for them to express their pronouns because it's asked in the public schools here in Massachusetts anyway.
That's a good thing, right? I mean, it's certainly stuff that we weren't talking about.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, it's great because it normalizes that. And honestly, what I've done now as well is I only use gender neutral pronouns in the classroom. There's no reason for me to use he and she. And then I don't offend someone.
Just be easier in general in life, wouldn't it, really, if we stop using he and she?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot stand it when someone says, excuse me, miss. It's like, first of all, I'm not in the military. You know what I mean? Like, I hate it. When people use the word sir, hello, sir, welcome to Home Depot. What can I help you with today, miss? It's like, just say, what could I help you with? Why are...
I know. And then there's that always embarrassingly awkward moment when they realize that they've misgendered you and then they apologize about 1,000 times and it makes it even worse.
It happened to me. Yeah, it happened to me in a hardware store. Yes, it's embarrassing. And they apologize over and over again, which is just so dumb. It's like, I already said, don't worry about it. I just want to move on. I don't want you to bring it up again because you're just digging a hole, which is like ridiculous. And the point is, if that person had just said, hi, can I help you find something? Then that never would have happened. Clearly, no one is teaching people who work in service industries to not use gender. And I'm shocked that at Starbucks, because that's where I go to Starbucks a lot. I really like their coffee. So I'm shocked that hasn't been taught to the people.
Yeah, I mean, they, I'm sure they had the same advert in America, but they had a whole advert here where it was about a young trans kid going to Starbucks and using their name for the first time, and it being a really empowering, important thing that they were, you know, having their name respected and their pronouns respected. So yeah, that surprises me.
Yeah, I saw that commercial. That was awesome. Mm. It made me like cry. And so the next step on that is to teach people to just stop using sir and ma'am and miss. Just stop doing it.
Yeah, big events. You don't need to say ladies and gentlemen. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
Anyway, we talked a lot about gender, but let's move the conversation a bit to sexuality, shall we? So was there a moment where you realized that you weren't straight, that you were attracted to the same gender as well?
Yeah. I have a photograph, actually, of myself in kindergarten playing the Little Red Rabbit with wings in a play. And there was a little girl who was my friend, and I can't remember her name, but I have a picture, and she was playing the other character and I was playing the rabbit, and they were playing, I don't know what it was, an angel of some kind or something. And there's a picture of me singing, and this little girl was standing right next to me. I mean, we're both five or something. And as soon as I saw the picture, it just was flooded with emotion of just adoration for this young girl that I was friends with. I was like overcome, like, oh my God, I loved her so much, you know. But that's just to give an example of how just enchanted I was with girls. You know, I mean, from a young age, I wanted to play with boys and be seen and do boy things. And being around girls made me feel very happy and very effusive. As I grew older, obviously, into like elementary school, I had a couple boys, you know, that I kissed and stuff. And that was fun. And then in junior high school, I think is when I started to have some dreams about kissing a girl or girls, you know, a couple of girls in my middle school, particular friends of mine. And that was weird. And I didn't tell anybody, but I still had boyfriends and I was into them. They were friends of mine that I did other stuff with. And then they were my boyfriend. And so I'd make out with them and stuff. But I didn't have a girlfriend or a woman, a same sex partner until I was 16. So I was young, I guess.
Okay. So but any time before 16, were you getting othered at all? Were kids picking up on the fact that you were quite tomboyish or slightly different? There wasn't any element of bullying then at all?
Yeah. So I think the reason why I got away with that, because that didn't really happen to me, was because I had an older sister who was really popular, and she was a ballerina, and she is beautiful. And my father was a teacher in that town, and a very popular teacher. So he was really well liked, and our family was well known in the town. It's a small town. And I was very good at music, and I was a real chameleon. I was friends with all kids. I was friends with the jocks and the cheerleaders and the arty kids and the loners. I was not really in one clique. Mm. And so I think that because of that, I was seen as a anomaly, and I was accepted in that way. There were times where I felt like that there was probably some laughing about me behind my back, but I really only remember that a few times. And then one sleepover party, I went at my friend's house, and I want to say it was probably my like eighth grade, maybe ninth grade. And this friend of mine, we were all standing in the street. We were having a sleepover. So we created tents in her family's backyard. We put up a couple tents, and there were girls and boys there. And she said to me, "What are you, a lesbian?" Everything in me sunk. And I just wanted to start crying. And it was just terrible. I just felt like seen and embarrassed again, and found out, and then lying, because I immediately just started lying.
So you knew that you were then, but there was no way you were going to tell her that on a sleepover.
Yeah. I mean, I knew I was something like that. I never really identified with the word lesbian. I mean, the people that I have had sexual relationships with, I've had them with both people who've been born male and female. So I've mostly had female sex partners. I've had mostly that, but I have definitely fallen in love with men before. And I've had a couple relationships with men that have been important in my life. Mm. I mean, in my 30s, I had a relationship with a man that was pretty specific. So it wasn't wasn't a sexual relationship, but it was a relationship for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can see why you identify as queer then, because you wouldn't say you were 100% lesbian or anything, would you? You were more pansexual, yeah, really.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's that I just feel like people are sexual. Like, maybe I don't need to decide for everybody else how I express myself, how I have, or what kind of sexual intimacies I choose to have with people. I really don't believe are based on their gender, on their assigned gender. I really don't. I have never felt that way. And it has landed that it is normally, it has been predominantly 90 or 95% of the time women, but you know, who knows what on the spectrum of those, I have no idea. When I think about all the women that I've had relationships with in the past that would have been considered back then just lesbian relationships, I think a lot of the people I've been with have been on pretty big swings of sexual identity and sexuality. Mm.
So was there ever a moment then where you decided to do the whole mom, dad, I'm gay, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that happened when I was after my first girlfriend. So my junior summer, so I was 16. Mm-hmm. So I had my license. I had just gotten my license. So it was the summer before my last year of high school. I did a summer program, a music program at Berklee College of Music, where I would go to college and then I would teach at. And in that summer program, I kissed a girl for the first time. And she was from Florida. Her name was Jamie. And I'll never forget it. And she was a little older than me. She might have been 18. I was 16 and a half. And she presented very feminine. She was very female. She had long hair and larger breasts and you know what I mean? And I'm not, obviously. So I'm like pretty, I mean, I have fantastic tits, but that's the whole other story. So, but like, I don't really have hips, you know, so I'm very androgynous in a lot of ways. And anyway, she sang this Janis Joplin song to me in her dorm room. I was alone in a dorm room with her and she was like wearing jeans and her bra and she sang Janis Joplin to me. And I was like having an out of body experience. I had never kissed a girl before. I had a boyfriend that I had a picture of in my blue Velcro wallet. It's 1987 at this point, you know? And she said, you know, don't you? Because then I took her on a drive and she put her hand on my leg and I was like, oh, you know, like, the feeling of the first time somebody puts their hand on your body or holds your hand. And it's just so intense, you know, nothing else has happened yet. And it's just electrifying. She said, you know, don't you? And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, you know that you're a lesbian. And I was like, I'm not a lesbian. I have a boyfriend, you know, here's his picture. And then we were standing near what's called the Christian Science Center. It is a reflecting pool there in Boston near Copley. It's kind of near Copley Square, really close to Berklee. And we were standing there and she said, you know, I started walking and she did that thing where she said, you know, come here. And then she classic, you know, come closer. And then she kissed me and I felt everything in my body dropped. And I just felt like relief. I just was like, ugh, that makes sense. Like, it's not like I didn't like the guy I was dating in high school. He's a really cool guy. I liked him a lot, but kissing him didn't feel like what this felt like. And as that kiss was happening and I was having this magical moment of understanding of who I was and myself, these two other people walked by, a man and a woman, and they were holding hands and they saw us kissing. And at that same, so that beautiful moment was absolutely crushed by this moment of hiding. So these people saw us and I immediately got scared and it ruined. It just stopped it. I don't know if you've had that experience where you're like in it and then, you know, judgment of the world passes you by and puts the kibosh on it, or you're holding hands in a subway and then somebody looks at you and you stop holding hands. That was when that began. That's when the hiding began for me.
So did you carry on and have a relationship then? Being, or?
What? Me and Jamie?
Yeah.
No, that was it. No, she just kissed me. And then I had a girlfriend that I met that next year. And that's when I came out to my parents. So after that summer, I definitely had this I hit a depression and I was going through, well, because I mean, obviously I had just like had this major life event. And my parents they could tell something was going on. I have a very close family. So I'm very, very, very lucky in that way. I remember I was in the car with my dad and I said, Dad, I think I might be gay. And he said, do you want to talk to somebody about it? You know? And I was like, okay. And he was like, well, you know, we'll find somebody to, you know, if you want to talk about this and help you feel like, you know what's going on and that you feel safe and I love you. And let me see if I can find somebody. So that was really cool. And he found a therapist for me to talk to. And she was fantastic. And we did some sessions together as a family. And I remember when I did come out, it was all of us. It was my sister and me and my mom and dad. And Dorothy said, Melissa wants to tell you something today. And I told them that I was gay. And they all said they loved me. And I think my mom said, I love you no matter what. I want you to be who you are. The thing that makes me sad is that life will be harder for you. And I don't want you to, you know, she's my mom. She doesn't want me to have a harder life, you know, that you will be discriminated. You will have a harder life. That's what she meant. I mean, my mom is obviously 100% accepting as well, but she did grow up in a pretty intense Catholic environment. She was taught by the nuns and all that. And so a couple of days later, she said, you know, Liz, I prayed. I did a lot of praying around this. And the message that I got back was that God wouldn't let you fall in love with a woman if it wasn't okay with him.
Wow. Okay.
So I was like, that's cool. So.
So you actually did sit them all down with your therapist then? That's how it all panned out. Yeah.
I think pretty unusual for that time period. We're talking about 1987, but I have a pretty forward thinking mom and dad. I mean, they were always supportive. I mean, they never made me wear dresses. They just always let me be who I wanted to be and express myself how I wanted to express myself. There were a few occasions in my life where I feel like I did go through like having to wear something that I really didn't want to wear, but it didn't really affect me. It was on so few occasions that it's kind of one of those things where you're like, yeah, when you're a kid, sometimes you have to dress up when you go to so-and-so's wedding and it's a pain in the ass. I was obsessed with my first communion. I mean, that was a dress and a veil and I couldn't wait to wear it. I was like, oh, I just thought it was the greatest thing ever. When I'm embodying something, I like to embody it. So.
And then I guess you're always coming out, aren't you? It's kind of something that it happens in life on a day-to-day basis almost, doesn't it really? But I guess it really wasn't an issue in the music industry. Or was it? Did you have to make a decision to be out and proud as a musician?
Oh, yeah, I did. I mean, you know, my first record came out in 1993. When that record came out, we already had Melissa Etheridge was already out. She had recently come out. And I don't know if Katie Lang was out, but she might have been. And so it was very popular. It was very popular to come out at this time. I mean, popular is a strong word.
But there weren't many.
Was extremely famous, right? It was just an amazing thing that she had done. Total bravery. And her and Julie Cyphers was her partner at that time. They had a billboard in the middle of Times Square of the two of them naked with like a boa constrictor wrapped around them, or I don't know what it was. I mean, that's coming out. You know what I'm saying?
That's a statement. Yeah.
That's not doing an article in all the gay magazines. I mean, everybody already knows you're gay. So then Atlantic Records, which is the label I signed to, had hired a director of gay marketing. I think it was the first time that had ever happened. And it was this guy named Peter Galvin, who was out gay man, fantastic guy. And they wanted me to come out. They wanted to use that as part of my story. And I didn't want to do it. I wasn't interested in doing it. And I don't really know why. I just said I wasn't comfortable doing that yet. I mean, I knew I was queer, gay, lesbian, whatever. I knew I was. I had a girlfriend in high school and a boyfriend in high school. And then in college, I had a boyfriend and a girlfriend. And then I had just a girlfriend. And, you know, I lived with my girlfriend Liz in New York when I moved to New York. And then I came back to Boston. And I got the Morrissey tour. And on the Morrissey tour, I was like madly in love with my manager at the time and trying to get her to make out with me. And she wouldn't. And, you know,
that sounds like a fun tour to be on.
Yeah. I had a huge crush on Alan White, Morrissey's guitar player. You know, nothing ever. I mean, we were friends, but I think I had a crush on him. You know, so I was like, I knew I was queer. So that was 91, the Morrissey tour. And then it was only 2 years later that that record came out. And they said, we want to use this and use this as marketing. And I said, no. And I do think that that affected the amount of attention that was put on my record. So the record that they ended up promoting through that gay marketing division was Jewel's record. And Jewel's record, as we all know, exploded. And then in 1995, my next record came out and I wanted to come out and I wanted to do the publicity around it. And at that time, that was less about me wanting to do it for other people. That was more about me wanting to do it to try to help it get me famous. At the time, I didn't realize that. But with age, you know, you can look back on things and be like, you know, I know what my motivation was behind that. And it wasn't all pure. It wasn't all just for the good of other people. And it did get me more press and stuff like that. I feel a little bad about that. I guess that's why I'm telling you, you know, like talking about it. It would have been a more brave move to come out during my first record.
It's really interesting that there was this whole department, because I've spoken to people in the music industry in the UK, you know, after the 90s, and people are still being told, oh, you're going to sell less records if you come out as gay. So I'm surprised that in 90, you know, that early, the early 90s, that they were seeing it as a marketing opportunity, because, you know, it wasn't long since the AIDS epidemic and, you know, gay people in particular just been brandished the worst people on the planet. So it seems crazy to me that they would try and sell more records by being gay, because it's not particularly a liberal place, is it, necessarily?
No, for sure. No, I mean, unless you're on the coast, you know, on some of the coasts. No, I think that they thought it might, which is why they hired Peter. You know, I do think that there are plenty, I mean, if not all large companies have a particular amount of people that are marketing to the queer population, the gay population, to that market. It's a, you know, framing how you're going to try to market something. You need people that are in that mindset of like, okay, how are we going to promote this album and make sure that we reach this market because we think that they will love it, right? But I think that was a very forward thinking idea with all the movement behind, particularly Melissa Etheridge. And I know that there was a lot of excitement around that. And I was gay. So, and they knew I was gay, but come to find out to your point, Emma, they instead forced their focus on Jewel, who is not gay, but the gay market embraced her. You think, right? So that's that female singer songwriter. Gay women, queer women, and gay men who love female singer-songwriters, which there are many of, I think, in general, queer and gay people like great music. So it's kind of
pretty
like,
much, yeah.
Yeah,
you know. You say that. Look how they marketed Kylie when she had her comeback. It was totally marketed at the gay market, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And the gays have saved her career, didn't they, I think?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's an argument to be made that gay men are the tellers of what is going to be the next hit. Gay men are very, very on top of trend in not only, I mean, in music and in fashion and in places to live and art. And so I think that having the gay male population as a, I don't really want to say a test market, but in a way, if you send a song to that market, you get your song in the clubs, right? When you do remixes and stuff. And if those songs float, there you have a shot. You have a shot of something taking off.
Yeah. So any advice for people that are, or maybe a younger you, any advice for a younger you going through it all again?
When I haven't listened to my intuition, my soul, my God, whatever you want to call it, different people call it different things, that truth moment, when I haven't acknowledged it and listened to it, I have suffered the consequences. You know, whether it be relationships or contracts or hiring other people or drinking, you know, I've been sober for a long, you know, so like back in my drinking days of like, do I really want, you know, it was like just any of those decisions I knew. I couldn't have changed it because I wouldn't be where I am, but I do try to really teach and talk about, you can't really teach it, but talk about with my students how important it is to listen to your instincts and that you are right. You know what I mean? Like when your gut tells you that you shouldn't do something, trust it. It's, you know what I mean? Even if other people are like, nah, you should totally go out with her. She's amazing. If there's a part of you that's just like, there's something about this isn't right. They're not the right ones. You know what I mean? So I have lived a life where I've trusted my gut a lot. So I will give myself a lot of credit for that. I have a real connection to it, my instinct and that part of me. But there, the occasions that I haven't listened to it, I have suffered the consequences. So
teaching the next generation, are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, for sure. 100%. So I teach this course called Record Industry. I teach at Northeastern University now. I was at Berkeley for 7 years, and now I'm at Northeastern in the music industry department. So I teach pretty much three, sometimes a fourth course there. And so one of them is just, you know, Introduction to Music Business, which is a massive course and really fun. And it just hits on a little bit of every aspect of the music industry. And then I teach a course called Record Industry, which is specifically about the record industry and different kinds of record labels and stuff. And then I teach an advanced songwriting course. And then I teach another, the fourth course that I pick up every few semesters is a course pretty much about the intersection of psychopathology and creativity. And that's really where I'm interested in doing more research, right? That's my jam, is critical creative thinking, creative practice, and the psychology of that. And so in that class, we were talking about managers in the music industry. So we were talking about managers, and I had said, what do you all think the most important job of a manager is? And they all said, I had them write it down. There are only 10 people in the class. So I got these, I had them hand me their 10 pieces of paper, and they're anonymous. So, you know, and I look at them, and every single one of them was, take care of the well-being of my artist.
Wow.
And I was like, the emotional and physical well-being of my artist, like literally specifically about their emotional well-being. And I just thought, this is such a far cry from where I came from. No one was noticing that I was having manic episodes or depressive episodes. Nobody said anything about the excessive drinking that I was doing. No one gave me time off. No one said, you know what? You probably shouldn't be doing 230 shows a year driving by yourself. You need a break, you know, like take 2 weeks off and go away. No one was taking care of me in that way.
And you burn out then, yeah.
Oh, completely burn out. Yeah. And we see that with artists now. We see artists die. But more and more, there's a lot of focus on well-being and self-care. And the students that I have, these 18-year-olds they're all about it. It's no joke. It is at the top of their list, is taking care of themselves, which is incredible.
Wow. Well, I'm optimistic. I don't know about you. That sounds pretty awesome. So is there any time for more songwriting, or is it all teaching now?
No, there is time for songwriting. And I think that that's a lot of what's been going on this summer. So I'm in the middle of doing a cover song right now for the record label Kill Rock Stars Records. And so I'm doing a Slater Kinney cover, which is really, really exciting. I'm doing You Ain't No Rock and Roll Fun. And then I'm working on a very large project to come out in 2023. And in between the Slater Kinney and the 2023 release, I will probably be putting out at least an EP, if not another full album. So that'll be next year. I'm shooting for next July, June, July, around Pride time.
Well, best of luck with it all. And just before you go, I want to know, because you shared the stage with some amazing people. Who was the most exciting for you to perform with?
Well, Morrissey will always hold an incredibly important place in my life, because what happened that day and his decision to ask me to finish the tour on July 5th completely changed the trajectory of my life. So, or it ignited it.
Yeah. And was he nice to work with, though? He's very Marmite, isn't he? People have very different opinions of him.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, he was nothing but incredible to me. His performances are outstanding every single night. He gave everything he had. His songwriting is incredible. I mean, I thought the whole experience for me was fantastic. He paid me a lot of money. He put me up in the same hotels that they were staying in. He took care of, his crew took care of me. So I had a great experience with that. So that was really important. But then I think when Tegan and Sarah opened for me in the United States, that was a really important and fun tour. And then I would just say the many occasions I've had the opportunity to open for Ani DeFranco. I mean, she became a friend and a confidant in a lot of ways. And we're the same age. We were born a couple days apart. We grew up through the same time period. And her lyric writing particularly just is, I find, really inspiring. And once I opened for Katie Lang, and I'll tell you, I got to watch her run a sound check, and it was like, it was watching a master. You know, you're watching a master at their job. It just was mesmerizing. Yeah, Katie Lang pretty much takes the cake as far as the best live performer I've ever seen in my life, let alone have the opportunity to stand side stage and play before. I don't even really remember playing that opening set because I was so...
Yeah. A proper pinch me moment.
Yeah, I got to do the Joan Armatrading tour too. And I, you know, she's so, and her last US tour. So, and she was the reason I started. Down to Zero was the song I used to practice singing in my dorm room when I was at Berkeley over and over and over and over again. And I could never quite sing it in the same phrasing as her. So when I got to do that tour just a few years ago, I kind of felt like that was a moment for me where I thought, I'm good. I can just stop now, you know, like, and that was after grad school. You know, I had just gotten my EDM and then I got the Geonomic Trading Tour and I was teaching and I had turned 48, I guess. And I thought, you know, I can just go play some coffee houses now and again when I want to. I don't need to.
Yeah, but it's Geonomic Trading.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of going out on top, being able to do that tour. Yeah.
I think, yeah, I would die happy if I were you.
Yeah, I think I will. I'll remember them for sure.
Big thank you to Melissa. Go and check out her tunes. Don't forget, you can find out loads more about this podcast at our new website, comingoutstoriespodcast.com. You can listen back to past episodes, you can find out all about our book, or you can even put yourself forward for an interview. Go on, do it. We'd also like to hear from you if you're the parent of somebody who's LGBTQ+, for a new series called Meet the Parents. Next episode, you'll be meeting a young trans woman called Lorelei. She grew up hearing homophobic and transphobic language and really suffered with depression, but says coming out was one of the best things she ever did.
When I had, like, discovered that I was trans anyway, it was such a big mood boost. Partially, it was a bit of an ego boost, but it was such a good mood booster. Mm. I felt lighter. Like, it was just like a weight had been lifted off my head and off my shoulders. I was sleeping better, I was eating better. I had rediscovered hobbies and interests. And I discovered what was kind of in there all along that I had never known about.